This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the High Yield Cash Account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A High Yield Cash Account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, I was traveling for a couple of days. Anything happen in this economy this week? From American Public Media, yes it did. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Risnall. It is Friday, the 15th of July today. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here is the operating premise of this program today. This economy right now is complicated. There are things happening that are just, well, they don't make sense. So our challenge, the next 7, maybe 8 minutes or so of live radio, should we choose to accept it, is to pick apart some of the contradictions and accept it. Of course, we do that challenge. Neil Richardson is at ADP. Brian Chung is at Yahoo Finance on, I should tell you, before we get going, a terrible, terrible phone line, but we wanted his expertise anyway. Hey, you two.
Hi, Kai.
Hey, guys. Sorry about that.
Well, you know, it's not so bad. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, Neela, let me start with this. Consumer price index this week, 9.1%. What do you say? You're the trained economist on the panel.
That's high. And you don't need an economist.
There we go. Thank you very much.
Really deep insight here. You don't need an economist to know that prices are up. You just need to have a car and fill it with gas to know that prices are up. You just need to go to the grocery store, buy some milk, and know that food prices are soaring back to levels we haven't seen since 1979. The issue with this report is not that it just stepped up higher from 8.6% last month to 9.1% year over year this in June. It's that inflation looks to be more widespread. It's seeping into other components of the economy, namely rents and medical care. That's a bigger component of the household budget, and it's more persistent than even food and gas prices.
All right, Brian, let me throw a phrase at you and get your trained economic observer take, if not, necessarily a PhD economist. Peak inflation. Do you buy the White House's argument that, you know what, these numbers are stale and it's going to go down from here?
Well, if you're looking at a gasoline perspective, then yes, it's possible when you consider that the massive rise that we saw in the consumer price index report this week was largely due to the double-digit increases in the price of gasoline. Same story with the producer price index, the other reading of inflation that we got this week, 18.5% of an increase month over month. So those are all stories that kind of support that the Federal Reserve indeed might have to control prices to get things down, because that's leading into other inputs as well. But at the end of the day, that is something that is certainly suggesting that as prices have come down in gasoline over the last few weeks, maybe the July report will look a little bit better.
Neela, what do you make of some of the current, chatter, I suppose, that this report is going to make Jay Powell and the gang at the Fed raise rates a full percentage point when next they meet?
I think that's being discussed, and it's going to be discussed internally. even more than the chatter on the outside, because the Fed wants to make sure this comes down and they want to be aggressive about doing that. Everybody's lined up, I think, on the FOMC. That's the Fed's decision-making committee on that. But there may be some discussion around whether 75, three quarters of a basis point or 4% is warranted. The thing to remember is that no matter how aggressive they are, it's not going to translate immediately.
Right.
Fed policy acts with a lag. It's 6 months either way. In that period of time, and it's not just a perfect 6 months, it could be several months. Yeah. I'm just averaging here. In that period of time, the economy could change significantly. So being too aggressive up front may mean a weaker economy in the future. And so that is the delicate dance that the Fed has to do every single month. If they act too aggressively, they may cause the economy to weaken more than it needs to.
Brian, let me offer you this thought on the same issue, whether or not they're going to go a full percent. So last time, up until literally the last 72 hours before the meeting, we, that is to say, business and economic media, were saying, oh, yeah, it's going to be a half a percentage point. And then they came out and they whacked us with three quarters of a percentage point. I wonder if Powell and the gang now are saying, you know, we can't do that twice in a row. We can't be telegraphing three quarters of a percentage point this time and then come out and do more because our credibility is on the line. What do you think?
Well, I mean, to Neil's point earlier, I mean, that's certainly one reading of it, given that that was exactly what happened last time. Why wouldn't the Federal Reserve repeat the same playbook this time by doing a little switcheroo at the last minute? But the difference is that the CPI report that we got this week did not come during what is called the Fed blackout period. Essentially, this is standard, a 9 to 10 day period where Fed officials agree not to speak to the media or make public comments before they go into that policy setting meeting that's scheduled because they don't want to rattle markets. Now, this was not part of the blackout period this week, at least. So after the CPI report that we got on Wednesday, you had Fed Governor Chris Waller coming out and saying he still supports a 0.75% increase, although he could be convinced to do a more aggressive 1 percentage point increase if the housing data, inflation expectations, retail sales look a certain way. So that certainly set a little bit before. But again, we're in the blackout period as of this weekend. So if there's more data, I don't know, maybe you see that little switcheroo again.
Yeah. All right. So, Neela, let's get to some of the conundrum of which I spoke at the beginning. And this is It was on Twitter this morning from Jason Furman, who used to run the Council of Economic Advisors in the Obama White House. And he pointed out a couple of inconsistencies. One, consumer sentiment is terrible, but we are still spending. And we're going to talk about that with Kristen Schwab in a minute. But there are a couple of other things he pointed out. Jobs are going up, right? We're gaining jobs. And yet gross domestic product, the economy is shrinking. Prices are going up. But wage growth has started to slow a little bit. Can you help make sense of some of that?
Yeah, and I was thinking about the perfect analogy of this, and I think it's a Skittle. Imagine.
I'm sorry, a Skittle? Right?
Yeah. Okay. Imagine you have a jar of Skittles, and there's 22 million of them, strong wind, we call the pandemic, knocks them all over. And so you're starting to fill that jar back with more Skittles every month, and sometimes a million, sometimes 500,000. It slowed a little bit, but it's still strong, above 300,000. And you're right back to where you were in 2019 in the number of Skittles. But that does not take into account all those Skittles you would have collected had it not, that jar not been knocked down. And that's what's missing in the economy. The economists estimate that 5 million more jobs would have been created had it not been for the pandemic. So yeah, the job market is tight, but we also have a smaller workforce than we otherwise would have, and a really stubbornly low labor force participation rate, meaning people aren't rejoining at the same rate that they did before the pandemic. And that partially explains, not completely, the conundrum between a really tight labor market and a slowing economy.
Brian, do you get that when regular people look at this economy, they're like, what the heck is going on? And how can people say the economy is strong when I'm paying $6 a gallon at the corner of, you know, my Shell station and food is more expensive? I mean, there's a gut check, a vibe thing going on here.
Yeah, and the vibes are just quite frankly not good, right? And this is, I think, what I call the disclaimer economy. I mean, when you take a look, for example, at consumer confidence numbers, I mean, it's not so clear that we want to see a consumer confidence number start to crater. But that might be what's necessary to lower the demand that has been in part due to the high inflation that we've seen. And that is not at all to blame the American consumer for what we're seeing in inflation. That's why it's so difficult to read this economic data. I mean, I tweeted earlier today that really the best way to read econ data is using emojis, like a combination of like a crying emoji, but also like a sunglasses emoji. Because, again, it's great that consumers are buying things. It's not good if they're buying things at a much higher cost than they were pre-pandemic.
Neela, super quick on the last question. Do you think CPI this week, the inflation reading, makes the Fed's now kind of questionable soft landing basically impossible?
It's not impossible. It's not going to be impossible until all the data is in, until we're, you know, far from where we are now. But it does make it harder.
Yeah. Neela Richardson at ADP, Brian Chung at Yahoo Finance. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Hello.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. Take it easy. Wall Street today was, in point of fact, all sunshine and light, baby. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, as promised, the consumer conundrum in this economy right now. We are cranky. We're just really cranky. And yet we keep on spending. Retail sales for June came out this morning, up 1% from a month earlier. Yes, a lot of that is about the rising price of gas and groceries. I get it. But still, overall, Americans are spending, crankiness and all. So, Marketplace's Kristen Schwab tries to square that circle.
When it comes to consumers and the economy, experts look at a bunch of data points to try to figure out where things are moving, kind of like arrows on a roadmap. And right now, those arrows are pointing left, right, forwards, backwards. Ted Rossman is an analyst at Bankrate.com.
There are some weird sort of irregular aspects to all this.
For instance, electronics and appliances have seen the biggest drop in sales in the last year, more than 9%. That might mean people are putting off big purchases because they're worried about their wallets. At the same time, spending at bars and restaurants is still strong.
And it's a key discretionary sector that I think people could easily cut back on if they were especially worried about inflation.
Rossman has a few guesses about what's happening here. One is that we've been living in a K-shaped economy in which inflation is hitting low-income Americans the most. Another is that among people who can afford to spend, there's still this huge pent-up demand for experiences like travel, since people have already gorged on goods. Simon Blanchard, who researches consumer psychology at Georgetown University, has another theory that people are worried about inflation, but they're not panicking yet. And that's showing up in how and where they're cutting back.
You don't want to start sprinkling your losses everywhere you're at.
People might be making trade-offs, maybe switching to store brand cereal to save a buck so they can still go out for ice cream, or going out for drinks but only having one. Whatever the answer is, the fact that people are worried about the economy but are still spending is confusing for businesses. Sucharita Kadali, a retail analyst at Forrester, says it makes it hard for companies to project future sales and figure out what to stock.
Typically, when you see a recession coming, you stop ordering.
But sales numbers tell retailers they should keep ordering, give the people what they want.
It's more important to look at what people are doing, not what they're saying.
What's that phrase? Actions speak louder than words? I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
You want a real tangible indicator of the economic effect the Federal Reserve's interest rate increases are having? Well, allow me to direct your attention to the mortgage market. According to the government's mortgage conglomerate Freddie Mac, a fixed-rate 30-year home loan can be had for 5.51% this week. That is up from 2.8% a year ago. So with that in mind, we gave our real estate person, Cynthia Cummins, a call. She's a realtor and the founder of Kindred SF Homes up in San Francisco.
Business is very interesting. we were churning along with record sales prices, crazy year over year, low days on market, people just desperate to buy property. And then that just sort of all came to a screeching halt. People stopped buying houses in San Francisco. The sellers, people who really need to sell, we can't be hopeful about pricing anymore. We have to be realistic. So here's what was happening in February. A house came on the market. Let's say they were asking $1.7 million, and there would be 10 buyers lined up and interested in it. And those buyers would compete. That same property listed today, it's probably one buyer bringing in a low offer and negotiating with the seller. 6 months. I think we're in for a little bit of a roller coaster. It's going to be up and down. So I'd like to just see, I'd like all of the listings that I have to sell. And I'd love to help some motivated buyers find a great property. Newer agents in particular are pretty worried that they're not going to be able to make a living. And buyers are worried that they're going to pay too much money in a market that's declining. Whereas I know they were paying too much before in January and February. I don't have a crystal ball, but I do know that things have a way of working their way out eventually.
That was Cynthia Cummins. She's the founder of Kindred SF Homes up in San Francisco. Coming up.
Picking up the phone and calling to talk to a stranger is a hard thing to do.
Yeah, it really is. Actually, that's true. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 658 points. That is not a typo. More than 2.1% closed at 31,288. The NASDAQ gained 201 points, 1.8%, 11,452. The S&P 500 up 72 points, 1.9%, 38.63. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow lost almost 0.2%. The NASDAQ slipped 1.6%. The S&P 500 gave up 0.9%. Those better-than-expected retail sales numbers that Kristen Schwab is telling us about were good news for retail stocks. Walmart grew almost 1%. Lowe's built up 1.3%. Macy's added more than 2.1% today. Boy, I'll tell you what difference a day makes for bank stocks, huh? Yesterday was all gloom and doom after JPMorgan Chase and Morgan Stanley released underwhelming quarterly results. And then today, Citigroup beat expectations, added more than 13%. Everybody else said, yeah, I'm in. JPMorgan pocketed 4.6%. Morgan Stanley rose 4.5%. So there you go. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down 2.93%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look, payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We've got some hard data in hand now to flesh out a trend that we have talked about on this program a lot. The noticeable increase in the number of workplaces trying to unionize. The National Labor Relations Board reported today that over the past 9 months, it has seen a 56% increase in petitions. That's workers formally filing with the board for a union election. And in fact, the number of petitions filed in just the first three quarters of this federal fiscal year, which started last October the 1st, is already more than were filed in all of the prior fiscal year. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino breaks it all down.
It certainly feels like there's been a surge of union activity making headlines at big companies like Amazon, Starbucks, and Apple, says Rebecca Given, a professor of labor studies at Rutgers. But she says the absolute number of workers unionizing is still pretty small.
Some of what's in this count is a large number of relatively small workplaces. A Starbucks coffee shop with maybe 20 workers and an Amazon warehouse with 6,000 workers. Each of those is just one election.
320 of the petitions came from Starbucks, more than 16% of the recent tally. But Given says the constant drumbeat of new union drives creates a certain perception, and perception matters. Neha Kremen is a barista at a Starbucks in Oklahoma City that voted to unionize last month.
I don't know, it's just really inspiring, just seeing store after store winning across the nation.
Kremen is 24 and says many of her coworkers are also young, a demographic that has been a key part of recent union drives.
I think a lot of us have felt hopeless about the future. And I think for a lot of us, unionizing was like a beacon of hope, you know, like, oh, we can do something. We can affect meaningful change.
Some recent organizing efforts have been in labor strongholds like healthcare, but many have been in industries like restaurants, retail, and nonprofits where unions aren't as established, says Ruth Milkman, a labor sociologist at CUNY.
What a lot of these have in common is that college-educated demographic. So I think it's the combination of frustrated expectations and then also the political worldview of this new generation.
Of course, these efforts have happened against a backdrop of historically low unemployment, which has given workers more leverage. Milkman says it's hard to say if the enthusiasm will persist if we end up in a recession. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
There's a new mental health resource coming online this weekend. Maybe a better way to say it, actually, is that there is a newer and easier way to get access to existing mental health resources. Right now, when a mental health challenge for somebody becomes a crisis, the first place a lot of people turn is to the telephone and to a patchwork of local crisis hotlines and the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. That's an 800 number that connects counselors with callers from around the country. Starting tomorrow, though, there will be a new and simple three-digit number for mental health crisis calls, 988. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, getting that switchover done is only half the challenge.
When you dial the new 988 National Mental Health Emergency Line, the first thing you hear is...
One moment.
And then...
If you are in emotional distress or suicidal crisis or concerned about someone who might be... We're here to help. Para español, oprime número dos.
You can press 1 if you're a veteran. Or wait to be connected to a local crisis center based on your area code. In Oregon, that might be Lines for Life, a Portland-based nonprofit where Deborah Diedrichson manages counselors and answers calls.
Picking up the phone and calling to talk to a stranger is a hard thing to do. It's really difficult. To be vulnerable, it takes a lot of courage and strength just to reach out.
And yet, as of 2020, the system that 988 calls will now feed into
could only meet the needs of about 85% of its callers.
Heather Saunders at the Kaiser Family Foundation says that means roughly 1 in 7 callers got dropped or hung up before a crisis counselor answered. And she worries the problems could get worse.
When 988 rolls out, it's anticipated that the call volume will up to triple the first year alone and then continue to grow from there.
In fact, increasing the number of people who seek help is part of the point of switching to 988.
The concern is if there were challenges with the current infrastructure meeting the call volume, people might reach out to the new 988 number in a state of crisis, but not be able to reach someone on the other side of the line.
And that could cause people to abandon their efforts to contact what's supposed to be the new easy-to-access number for all mental health problems, says Jody Mance at the National Academy for State Health Policy.
If call volume overwhelms a system, you're going to see higher levels of abandonment, right? Because people are going to be waiting. That's the thing giving folks in state policymaking, advocates, stakeholders the most anxiety.
Part of the problem is there's been relatively little state and local funding, planning, and resources devoted to 988. The RAND Corporation recently surveyed 180 mental health directors across the country, says RAND's Jonathan Cantor, to find out
whether or not there would be long-term budgeting for this. That was lacking, which was concerning. Only about 1 in 7 respondents had established a budget to support 988.
And of those, fewer than half were expanding local call centers, adding staff, marketing the new number, or figuring out how to coordinate between 911 and 988. Only 13 states have passed dedicated funding mechanisms so far. The lack of funding is especially problematic in states that already have a poor track record answering crisis calls. States whose residents often end up speaking to counselors elsewhere, says Jody Manns at the National Academy for State Health Policy.
The ideal response would be to have somebody who's local, who understands local resources, you know, the local provider landscape, those sorts of things.
In Illinois, just 21% of calls are answered by in-state call centers. In 4 other states, Texas, Arkansas, Minnesota, and Wyoming, less than half of all calls are answered in-state. The calls that in-state centers can't handle spill over to backup sites, like Oregon's Lines for Life, which has increased staffing and expects mental health emergency calls to double in the next year. Crisis Line Director Deborah Diedrichsen tries to make sure every one of those calls is answered promptly with knowledge and compassion.
People do sometimes have to wait. I work every day to prevent that. And in fact, the national standard for 988 is that we answer 95% of calls within 20 seconds.
Meeting that goal would ensure that more people who reach out get the help they need. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, tip of the hat to CNBC for doing the legwork on this one. What people bought the most of during Amazon Prime Day this week, days, really, Tuesday and Wednesday, and what that can tell us about this economy. A lot of basics, trash bags and dishwasher pods, food, in particular, Frito-Lay snack packs. Go figure that one out. Small ticket items were the way to go, apparently. Almost 60% of the items sold on Prime Day were under 20 bucks. And also, can I just say how weird it is that this company has basically co-opted everybody into thinking that a day it invented that makes it billions of dollars is actually, like, a thing? All right, we are out of here, but not, of course, without your moment of economic context. And on to the second biggest economy in the world today. China's National Bureau of Statistics said this morning the Chinese economy grew at an annual rate of just 0.4% April to June. We here will get our first look at second quarter growth in about a couple of weeks, 28th, I think. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a good weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.